This is a production of Cornell University.
UA meeting November 19th, 2008.
All right, everyone, we're going to get started. I thank you all for coming. We're not normal members, and also normal members, thank you. I think just to start off, because we have so many people, let me go around for introductions for our guests. I guess starting on this side over here, so you get an idea of who's in the room. Just the introductions.
I'm Tim Fahey. I'm on the faculty. I'm with the President's Climate Commitment Implementation Committee.
And my name is Dan Roth. I'm in Environmental Compliance Sustainability and I'm the Communications Coordinator for the Climate Action.
Amy O'Donnell from the Cambridge Office.
Are we just doing
guests?
Dana Amundsen will be here from Beverly. University planner.
And I'm Annette Marshall, so I'm with Trowbridge and Wolf Landscape Architects. I'm filling in for Catherine Wolf. We were the consultants on the TGUS, and I'm here with David Lee.
And I'm David Lee with Transportation Services. I'm here today to talk to you about TGUS in the interest of full disclosure. I also serve on the President's Climate Commitment Implementation Committee, and as will also be germane, I'm chairman of the board of Ithaca Car Share.
Okay, great. We'll start off with
Mark.
Do
you have another
guest? Oh, sorry. There's the other guest. I'm a little off.
I'm Erin coming from the
Does anybody have preference who goes first for presentations, just so we kind of get that out of the way? I know we were planning on going one of the presentations last from planning, design, and construction due to time constraints. Does anybody else have a preference for going first? No?
I'm leaving at 5:15. I didn't have a presentation, but I was going to participate in the discussion for the president's time.
Great. What we have on the agenda thus far, then, why don't we start with the constituent assemblies, starting with the student assembly, just keep them brief for today.
There's not necessarily much report from the student assembly. We're working on our own issues, be them gorge safety. We're looking at elections for the upcoming semester. Additionally, what other things have been done? We finalized our budget and the SAFC funding cycle for the fall semester. And that's pretty much it from the assembly. It's not anything really pertinent to discuss.
On the DSA?
We did think we finalized our budget. That was pretty much the
discussion. The EA?
As I said, we're just, there's really nothing specific to discuss. We're going to pass.
Faculty?
The President, members of the administration, Dave Harris and Mary Opperman, gave a presentation at the Senate meeting about the financial circumstance situation in the university. And Harris's presentation, he headed it up, was why are we facing budget challenges, what are our plans for addressing those challenges, and what are we presently doing? What are the long-term plans? What are we presently doing to address them? Most of the presentation was a elaboration of things that we all may have read. The President has said in communications in the Sun and other forums, and there were questions from the Senate of various sorts. Having to do with different issues that were raised. One issue that was important to many senators was whether or not adding to the tuition base by not increasing but by adding students to the numbers was one option being considered to what were the implications for programming and for the facilities in the university. Another question that was asked was about where does sustainability fit in the mix of problems with finances, whether it's an expendable issue because it's too costly or inappropriate, and that was quickly that we were reassured that sustainability was a central point, but that was a factor in all decisions about financial savings and, you know, financial problems. But one had to consider whether the payoff was, what was the theory of the payoff for a sustainable initiative or for, in the process of discussing finances. There was a discussion about the moratorium on building, and I think probably you've all read about that, but the moratorium on building, it has certain exceptions in it that were clarified in the process of that discussion.
Great. Something I think that kind of, I think, frames our discussion rather well in terms of finance and sustainability. Another thing to consider that I kind of want to frame this discussion through is what is the role of this body in acting as, in my mind at least, kind of a central hub for organizing a lot of these different groups on campus, bringing them together in a room to kind of just discuss all of these various ideas that are floating around. Start off, I guess, with CJC.
The CJC met 2 weeks ago, and basically what we went over is discussing the things we want to accomplish this upcoming semester. It started off, Kathy's owner updated us on the JA's office and what they would like to see as far as jurisdiction over the gorges and swimming. And we also covered how the J board is going to be going through a staffing drive. Our next meeting is actually tomorrow at 4:30, if any of you are interested. And Kathy's owner has an official bill that we will be, and a resolution we'll be going over about swimming in the gorges, as well as we've invited a student concerning, he had an issue with defamation that he wanted to pick up. And then a professor wanted to bring the concept of reputational interest at the university. And we've invited both of them to speak. I'm not sure if they will attend. I know one of them for sure, the professor will be showing up, but I'm not sure about the student. And that's it.
Do you have any idea of a timeline when that will kind of be brought back to us yet at all?
Probably our next UA meeting. This, I think, will be probably the last CJC meeting on the semester. We're just trying to wrap it up.
I saw in the minutes that whoever wrote the minutes said that last month I gave Bob kudos to the campus planning committee, and then a few people in the university assembly asked me, is the campus planning committee serious about sustainability, and brought up Milstein specifically, and then I wrote to Barbara New, and she put it on the agenda so Milstein would be discussed at the campus planning committee. And I think it's probably fair to say that Milstein is a little bit of an exception to the whole sustainability thing, that sustainability isn't a top priority when it comes to Milstein, but it's not, has not been neglected either. But there's a lot of other things, for example, the accreditability, the accreditation of the architecture school that is riding on this. But I would say sustainability is a low priority in that project. And other people could chime in, and Marty was here. Two other things that were discussed at the meeting was Mike Hoffman gave a wonderful presentation on the CU Agricultural Experiment Station sustainability initiatives. And he's casting a wide net to get a lot of people involved, to get the ideas in there, and to get the ideas implemented in terms of collecting waste from the the dining commons, for example, and composting it and using it in the fields and just all kinds of things we'll probably hear about today. And the last thing that we talked about was a large animal testing complex that would be across from the vet school on the edge of the orchards, and it'd be used to be for Cal students and for vet students to understand different aspects of cows and dairy and milking, and it would be run as a, it would be run as a student-run business project learning experience where the students wouldn't have to go so far from campus as we discussed last year. Dan's worries to look at cows. And then there was some discussion about whether it should be a large complex or a smaller complex. Right now, people are talking about 180 cows.
Okay. And then the last thing that we have was some TAP that we set up.
Yep. So the Transportation Advisory Committee met on October 24th. It was set that future meetings, if anybody's interested in coming, will be on the third Fridays of every month. They occur about lunchtime, 12:15 to 1:30. It was largely the first meeting of the year, so it was a broad scope looking at issues for future meetings. David is the expert on this, but it's the car show was mentioned. Seems to be like a program which is going over very well. At that time, there were about 450 Cornell members. CU has purchased 2,000 memberships for faculty, staff, and students. And there are various rental options. I think this new program is going over, being received well. It was also mentioned that there's a commuter van pool program that's being sponsored by TCAT. This is open, again, to Cornell faculty, staff, and graduate students. And for people in Tompkins County to together collectively commute to campus in a van pool program. And Cornell offers various incentives for people to do that program. But more in the conversation which has come up in this body, the issue with bikes and bike safety on campus. I started by sort of outlining some of the topics which have come up in this, and then some other things through talking with people and looking around. So just some of the things which were brought up to them was the idea of the Big Red Bikes program, which various members have already been aware of. The topic of, you know, there needs to be more covered bike racks. The roads are narrow and not necessarily, and the bike paths leading to campus are not necessarily inviting for people to commute to campus. The dismount zones leave a little bit to be desired on the sidewalks. At nighttime, it's difficult to ride the bikes on campus. And then if you go onto the website and look for where are the bike routes on campus, just in general, I discovered that website is not exactly user-friendly. These were all things that basically people at TAP were aware of and are thinking about. One person that was there who I think would be excellent for University Assembly and anybody in general who's interested in the topic to talk to is Lois Chaplin. She attended the TAP meeting, and she this is an area she's very interested in, and a large part of her job is dealing with the bike issues on campus. And so a couple of the things just quickly that she noted was, yes, that there aren't enough bike racks. They're probably not the most desirable ones on campus, but as soon as they go in, they seem to fill up. And so there seems to be a more of a demand than the supply as far as biking accommodations. She noted that there is actually a committee that meets specifically to deal with bike issues on campus, and that meets in Riley Robb at 9 a.m. on the third Monday of every month. So again, that's something that people should be interested in going to. Last year, when I looked through the minutes of TAC, it was suggested at one of the previous TAC meetings that there should be a comprehensive bike plan. This is something that sounds like an excellent idea. And then when I brought that up, it came to this is still something that's on the mind, but there hasn't really been any headway made on the comprehensive bike plan. And I think that ties into something that we're probably going to talk about next, is that the TIMS section of the TGIS was mentioned as a good place to start looking at a comprehensive bike plan for the campus, that there could be some footholds there. And again, Lois Chaplin is somebody looking into this. She also mentioned that CU EMS is interested in starting sort of their own bike awareness program.
educating people, and then maybe students could become sort of bike ambassadors to educate people as the proper way to conduct yourself on bike paths and the rules that regulate biking on campus. Because it's not necessarily just a driver's problem. Bikers need to be responsible as well. As far as the bike path issue, which has come up here, and you know how inviting is it to bike on campus, it was mentioned that basically this is an old university and the infrastructure and layout is such that it's difficult to really install and implement a coherent, solid network of bike paths. And that one concern is the crossroads between bike paths and vehicles that, you know, that can create a point of danger, which is something I hadn't personally thought about, but it's good to show that people are thinking about these issues in detail. It was also mentioned that Congress apparently has passed a bill allowing employers to give incentives for people to commute on bikes. There's a $20 a month incentive, so maybe this is something that can be moved forward. Again, these are just ideas. PAC is planning on discussing this in more detail, but just to give people a rough idea of what went over. And so future meetings will discuss these things and in general, and then specifically a comprehensive bike climate, seeing how T guys can act as a foundation for such a plan. So, but I think that as far as this body, Willis Chaplin would be somebody that we should talk to and get more information from. She will hand it down and into this.
Right. And I know, Elizabeth, that's been something that you have been personally very interested in, so perhaps even you want to act as sort of a lean on to her to discuss that. I know something that
See, things would just be so easy. I'm always after the director of the Johnson Museum, because you've got that big overhang on actually three sides of the Johnson Museum, the one that faces south. It's really, really wide. I sometimes take my bike in there and park, but you could easily put a long rack. How much would it cost? I've offered to donate the money.
Which I would then collect.
Put that in the middle so I can approve. We put in the middle so I can approve.
So I guess we can start with presentations. I guess going into that, it'd be a good segue if you'd like to go first, unless there are any objections.
Sure. Is there? I don't know where the plug-in for the projector is. So I'm not sure why that's. Is somebody?
Sorry.
It just goes into the ceiling and vanishes.
I can go upstairs and
get the
volunteer.
I'm sorry?
The
table
with right
the
down to your right.
Okay.
Should be somebody somewhere
where it might be.
First, let me reintroduce Annette Marchessault, who is with Trowbridge and Wolf Landscape Architects. She is here as a proxy for Catherine Wolf, one of the principals. And they were our local consultant for the DGEIS process and have just been in it up to their ears for. Actually, the good news is the town planning board met last night. They really liked the FEIS, the final environmental impact statement, and things look to be on track for them to issue their finding statement this year, which will stop T-Guys from going into a fifth calendar year. So we're really rooting for that. It's a process that has gone on for a long time with a lot of public input. The document itself looks a lot like this. it's a big report. It's a heavy report.
Delivered to the planning board in bags like this, and hold everything.
So these are the appendices. We got a thick section in here which describes the current condition, that structure under New York State Seeker Law, State Environmental Quality Review Law, followed by impacts. The impacts are what would happen if growth happened at the university and there were no mitigations for that growth. And the section at the back is the one that, you know, we think most people are going to turn to first, which is the mitigation section, which is a sort of an unranked, you know, broad brush list of mitigations. From that comes this document. So all of this, the most interesting piece really is the TIMS, it's the 10-year transportation impact mitigation strategies. It really forms the basis of the strategic plan for Cornell Transportation Services over the next 5 to 10 years.
Could I get that for a definition of mitigation?
Mitigation, ways of offsetting or preventing impacts. So if the university were to grow and there were to be more single occupancy vehicles coming to campus, those would be the impacts. The mitigations are preventing those single occupancy vehicle trips from coming to campus.
It's just that in the first few guys that Trowbridge came up with, it seemed that mitigation meant widening roads and so on, and taking out parts of the story. My neighborhood was quite alarmed at the first few guys, because mitigation seems to mean if you were an obstacle to the flow of traffic, what would happen?
Oh, I don't think that was never a part of the
Well, it changed a lot and had to be clarified, but it
certainly
was a good theory.
As David mentioned, this has been going on for about almost 5 years now. And the intention always has been to try to find strategies to get vehicles off the road, to at least keep the amount of traffic that is traveling on the road from Cornell commuters at least at the same level as it is today, even if Cornell grows in population, and hopefully to reduce that in the future. The traditional way of mitigating transportation impacts of more vehicles on the road is to widen roads. This final document doesn't take that path. And I think as David goes through this this presentation, I think you'll see that even in the high growth scenario, we feel that the mitigation strategies that have been developed, such as car share programs or van pool programs or some of the transit options or encouraging people to bike or to walk, we feel that we can mitigate, even in the high growth scenario, up to at least 60 or 65% of the new additional traffic, keeping them off the roads through programs like that. So the strategies that have been developed in the TGIP and the TIMS are very, very focused on getting people out of FOB and into alternative modes of transportation.
I think Cornell, actually, Springbuck, who's the outreach coordinator for transportation services, presented to my building downtown today. And one of the statistics that really stood out is that everything Cornell has done so far from 1991 to now has saved 10 million road miles.
Per year.
So that is an example of the strategies that we've already employed to mitigate traffic.
And we believe that's been a good start. We're very proud of it. It's won us national awards. But we know that if the university grows in terms of number of people, that if we continue to have one-third participation, which is about what we have now in faculty and staff, that means two-thirds are driving single occupancy vehicles. And two-thirds of additional people taking single occupancy vehicles to work would not be sustainable for the university in any sense. So we're very proud of holding at 30% for about 19 years, but it's also one of our disappointments in the program over 19 years, is that no matter what we've tried to market it, to publicize it, that's where it's limited. So it seems to us that if people come and people go in the way they do at a university and the turnover happens the way it does and we maintain the one-third, that it's our programs that are the limiting factors and that we're not finding enough ways for other individuals to eschew the single occupancy vehicle in favor of an alternative mode of commuting. So that's what this is really focusing on. And a lot of this is underway already. We're very hopeful that being proactive with this, that we can mitigate impacts before they happen, which should yield a reduction in the number of single occupancy vehicle trips through the neighborhoods that surround the university. I went through this presentation last night with the University Neighborhoods Council, and including the questions and answers, it took about an hour and a quarter, and we don't have that kind of time tonight. So I'm going to be going through this very quickly, very broad brush, and I apologize that it's going to be, by necessity, somewhat general. One thing I do want you to know, even as we start, is this document, the TIMS document, is online and available at tgeisproject.org, tgeisproject.org. This is the draft TIMS document. So I'm going to go through this and get as much done in the next 10 minutes as I can. I'm happy to come back and discuss things in more detail, especially after you've had a chance to go through the TIMS and see what that makes transportation's programs look like over the next 5 or 10 years. Things certainly don't happen immediately. They don't happen overnight. A lot of what this talks about, a lot of the community infrastructure programs that the president has talked about investing in, $10 million over the next 10 years for transportation projects, a total of about $20 million, including transportation and housing. The president has reiterated his commitment to that, but has said there might be a slight delay or slowing down due to the financial constraints at the university. So some of what we're talking about in here might happen more slowly. Elizabeth, you can certainly attest to the fact that things seem to proceed at a glacial pace. It doesn't mean it's not happening or it's not in mind. But some things are more difficult than others, some things are more expensive than others, and some things have more bang for the buck than others. So all of that has to be taken together, and we'll try to do the best and the most we can in the best time that we can. So just a quick review of what TGEIS is. I mean, we talked about how it's forward-looking in terms of hypothetical population growth at the university. What happens if the population grows? And how can that provide a framework for transportation investments? Now, when I said transportation infrastructure investments, just to reassure you, it's not the widening of roads. Most of the projects that are being looked at are multi-use trails, fixing roadways so that there's better pedestrian and cyclist access. Pine Tree Road is an excellent example of a road that goes from East Hill Plaza, not so bad to cycle until you start going down that hill towards a railroad trestle that pinches the road so that the shoulder is about this wide, and the road surface is in terrible condition, a death trap for cyclists. So the town has, the county rather, has a project on the books. That's the county, isn't it? That one. To remove the old trestle and bridge to replace it with something where there's a further setback, you can get wider shoulders, you can get a safe bike lane all the way through. It would also provide an improved bridge crossing for the East Ithaca Recreation Way over Pine Tree Road. This is something where Cornell can help provide some of the local match money that can be leveraged then. So we're hoping that this $10 million that the president has committed for transportation can be leveraged into $100 million or more in local projects by providing the local match for state and federal funds. Kind of through that. Some of the research we did prior to this showed some of the existing commuting patterns at the university. We can see that faculty and staff, by far, are the population that tends to drive alone the most, in the 55% range. You've got the graduate students tend to be transit riders, and the overwhelming proportion of undergraduate students tend to walk as a commuting mode. These are some of the survey results. Again, this is a little too much to try and go through today, but there is the survey was of current choices and of sort of an attitudinal survey to get a good sense of what people might do and what kinds of changes would need to be made for them to make decisions to do things differently. There was a lot of public input. We met with the University Assembly a couple times during the early phases. The University Assembly and Student Assembly, Employee Assembly helped us develop the survey questions for the questionnaire. We have made interim reports. There were public workshops both on campus and off. Each of the University Neighborhood Council and Ithaca Neighborhood Council hosted two public sessions at two different phases of the project. Ithaca's Disability Advisory Council also hosted two meetings. There was a meeting adjacent to campus at Maplewood Apartments focusing on cyclist issues and questions and suggestions. There's sort of a compare and contrast with TGIST and Cornell Master Plan. One of the reasons we're in our fourth year of TGIST is we did put the project on pause for a while the master plan got underway and was completed in order for the two projects to inform each other. Mina was sitting on the working group for TGIST. My director, Bill Lent, was sitting on the master plan committee. There was a lot of conversation, a lot of inclusion of data and information, plans, suggestions, and ideas between the two so that they would inform each other. However, we have to bear in mind that TGIST was focusing on a much shorter time frame, now to 10 years from now, and the master plan was looking, 20, 30, 40, 50, 60 years and out. The master plan also focused on the borders of the campus inward, while TGIST was focusing on the communities surrounding the university through which commuters travel in order to come to campus, because that's where the majority of the impact lies. We really weren't looking on the main campus itself.
If I could just jump in and sort of build on that point, as David mentioned, the TGIST was really looking at commuters who come to campus, and our boundary sort of stopped at the edges of campus. And then the master plan, we took that up and focused on campus. Yes. So just reacting to the gentleman's comments about the bicycle plan and the TGIST being a foundation for a campus-wide bicycle network, that is true to a certain extent, although I think you'll find when you read through this document that it's going to focus on much more specific suggestions off campus. I think one of our recommendations was to enhance the on-campus bicycle network, but we didn't say specifically where or how because we sort of stopped at the edge. So off campus, we have specifics like Pine Tree Road or enhancing the East Hill Recreation Way or Van Hool or Carpool or downtown. So we identified some really specific recommendations for bicycles, but we stopped at the edge of the campus when we came to the specific.
Yeah, I think the master plan also has recommendations for on-campus bike network. Partly bike only, but also shared roadways for these trails.
So just to, if you read the TGIST and you don't see a specific on campus, it's not because you didn't think about them, but it wasn't our charge to come on campus and then you question them.
And the point is it recognizes that you have to make it easy for people, because it focuses on commuting, you have to make it easy for people to reach the campus, but also recognizes that the campus has to be an inviting place to cycle once you get here in order for it to be a successful endeavor. Quickly, the hypothetical population growth scenarios that were looked at, we're looking at a total campus population of 30,000, 10,000 faculty and staff, 13,000 or so undergraduate students, and about 7,000 graduate students. The growth was assumed to be all faculty and staff, not because we think that's where all is going to be, but because their commute tends to be the most impactful on the community surrounding the university. So by way of looking at it as a worst case scenario, it was assumed they would have the most detrimental commuting pattern to community livability. So in these scenarios, we're looking at scenario one is no new Cornell population growth. Unlikely, but it could happen right now, you know, at least over the next few months. Very likely to happen that way. But even if the university doesn't grow, there's likely to be, as there has been every year over the course of you know, decades, some degree of background growth. Cornell, while the largest employer in the county, isn't the only employer in the county, and there does just tend to be some degree of background growth, and so there will be normal kinds of municipal projects that take place. Scenario two reflects 0.1% per year, or 10%, I'm sorry, 1% over 10 years, 300 new people would create minor additional transportation-related impacts in addition to background growth, and that could be mitigated by enhancing our current TDM programs, investing in new programs, and making some infrastructure improvements to make the infrastructure more welcoming for cyclists, pedestrians, transit users. Scenario three was a 0.5% growth, or 5% over 10 years, 1,500 new people. Again, this would have some moderate additional impacts that we feel, again, could be absorbed reasonably by improved alternatives. It's not until scenario four, where you're growing at 1% per year at 3,000 new people at the university over 10 years. That's an extremely aggressive growth rate, which would yield significant additional transportation-related impacts. And in addition to TDM programs and infrastructure improvements, at that point, some physical roadway and intersection improvements in the local municipalities would probably be called for. So I mentioned about a third of Cornell commuters are already using these alternative means, OmniRide, RideShare, Cable Parker, enabling things like the emergency ride home. And now with the car share, help people to realize that they don't have to have their own car on campus in order to meet mobility needs. If you're bringing your car to campus just as a security blanket, what if I need it during the day because my child gets sick at school? You know, there's an emergency ride program that can address that. If you need it for, you know, just the occasional midday errand, if you're in one of these programs, you have a free membership in Ithaca CarShare available to you. And as an aside, all students can take advantage of a free Ithaca CarShare membership. You just have to go and enroll. And, you know, again, the university has purchased a bulk of them in advance to allow that to be possible. The VanPool program that was referred to earlier is a regional VanPool program. This is not a Cornell program. It's being hosted by TCAT and provided by BPSI, a national VanPool provider. But Cornell has provided the seed money. There's a certain local amount of money that needs to go into this to make it happen. It's a subsidy of $700 per van per month just to get the program going. Eventually, federal money can kick in for that because it's VanPool is technically an arm of public transit. So there are public transit subsidies, but there's a two-year lag on that money. So Cornell is fronting the first 2 years to the tune of about $200,000 to get that program started. Anyone commuting to or from Tompkins County would be eligible to join a VanPool. And if you picture a group coming from Syracuse, where a few people work at Cornell and a couple at Ithaca College, the fact that the last 2 miles of their commute is different shouldn't really matter all that much, because the first 57 miles of that commute they can take together in that van and drop off one place and park the other. It can be an extremely efficient program for people and a tremendous money saver, especially for the people who are commuting from further away. 25% of Cornell's commuters come from outside Tompkins County. We draw from an 8-county area. Yeah.
What about within Tompkins County, but at a distance? I mean,
oh, absolutely.
5 miles.
Yeah. At 5 miles, it may not pay for itself. At 10 to 15, it would begin to become worthwhile.
But could you pick up a van, pick up on a van that is coming in, like
sure.
in a park and ride situation where a van stops at a park and ride and then takes you in?
Could, but you'd probably, likely, as a member of that van, will be paying an equal share to the other people in the van. It would be up to the, it's, you know, to a certain degree, the vans have autonomy. They're driven by members, and you know, they form a group. They share the expenses of that van. Cornell commuters, faculty, staff, or graduate students will be subsidized $20 a month towards that, in addition to the $700 a month that Cornell will be paying for each van. Cornell's already begun providing free evening and weekend bus service privileges for graduate and undergraduate students. That continues in addition to the free first year of transit for all students new to Cornell. For the subsequent years, there's an OmniRide pass available for $200, also heavily subsidized. The same pass privileges from TCAT are $495 a year. So the university is investing a tremendous amount of money in making transit available to the community, the entire Cornell community. As a direct result of TCAT agreed that it was important to do a comprehensive system-wide route study. They're in the middle of, they've got a consultant now, and this is a study that can include just, you know, tearing the system down to its very roots and rebuilding it to fit the way the community has changed. This hasn't been done in 10 years, and even then it wasn't completely taken down to nil. So I don't know if it will be this time, but there's the potential for that to happen. There will be a significant public input phase for that. Please keep tuned for that, probably happening in January. But you know, since 10 years ago when the last study was done, there's been just tremendous change and development in this area that has changed the face of where the demand is, the demand patterns are for transit.
I'm curious. I heard a statistic that something like, I'm going to put this number out, there's probably not right, 60% of our emissions from transportation back and forth to campus are offset by the forests surrounding Cornell that are owned by Cornell. Do you know anything about
that? I'm going to leave that to my colleagues who are more expert in that and who are going to be speaking momentarily on the President's Climate Commitment, because the greenhouse gas inventory was a piece of that. So I think that I should probably leave it at that. There's more to say, but again, I'm happy to come back. I'm happy to answer any questions later on if time permits, and to discuss him at a future meeting. So I thank you, and I apologize if I've gone over. I've talked as fast as I could. Thank you. Thank you.
I have to go catch my bus, but it's a very valid excuse to get out of the meeting. But it really is gratifying. I've been teaching environmental conservation at Cornell for 30 years now. And the last 3 or 4, maybe 5 years, there's really been a sea change. I mean, just to see that many people on campus who are convinced that this is, you know, 10 years ago, the assembly would never have been considering these kinds of issues. So it's a great feeling. Mary Lynn took the class back for the first time.
I'm not quite that old.
Sorry, I can't stay, but we're well represented. There's 5 or 6 people on the implementation
class. It's the same presentation as you said.
Should I get going? Hi, everybody. I'm invited tonight to talk to you about Cornell's capital building program. So I've got slides of a whole bunch of projects that are in design or in construction. It's normally a 45-minute or an hour presentation, so I'm going to zip right through them. Before I get started, I'd like to introduce two colleagues. Mary Lynn Cummings is here. And Mary Lynn, I could guess at a title for you as Director of Space Planning and Appropriation or something like that. Mary Lynn's position is fairly new at the university to help Cornell be better at utilizing space and figuring out if there are alternatives to building new buildings and just helping us better be efficient. We were going to talk a little bit about the President's climate commitment, and Mary Lynn chairs a subcommittee of that smart growth, which is fitting with what she does here at Cornell. And then also Randy Lacey sitting in the back. Randy is university engineer and also associate director of project design and construction. And Randy also chairs a subcommittee of the climate action plan, the building energy subcommittee, which again the name implies to figure out ways that our buildings can use less energy. So thanks for joining me.
David, if you push the button, please.
Back up. And again,
so I'm going to start on the west side of campus and work my way east. Push it again, David. This is where we started the residential initiative back in 2003. One of the requirements of the residential initiative was that we not demolish the whole site at once, even though that would have been a convenient thing to do. The university had a commitment to the students to maintain the housing count, so we had to do a sequenced operation. The first thing we had to do was build a new building. We chose to build it on that parking lot that's pink. We moved that parking lot a block to the west, and it became Red Bud Woods. That some of you probably remember. And then, David, if you just sequence through these, I won't take any time to talk about them, but just keep right going. So this is the way we did it. Demolition projects are pink, and then the bright red are the new ones that we built. And I've been working on the residential initiative for about 10 years, and we finished it, and that's part of the final project product. Go ahead, David. Okay. I think, did it jump ahead?
Did it?
No. Okay, go ahead.
I did, but... Again?
Weil Hall is another project that we just finished. What a neat project this one was. Richard Myers, a Cornell graduate, Pritzker Prize-winning architect, designed this. It was his first lab building, and he did a terrific job. Another interesting thing about this is several colleges and different departments share this building, and it's become sort of a new trend for the university and the type of laboratories that we build. You probably read this is a LEED Gold building. It also meets the university's new requirement that our buildings use 30% minimum energy below code, so we call it a LEED 30 building, and we've just commissioned it. It's filled right up with people. Go ahead, David. My slides are all out of sequence. I don't know why, but I'll just keep going and we'll see what comes up. The Child Care Center is another one on North Campus that we finished in record time. This was a real scramble for us, and the youngsters were coming in August, and we got it done just in time. I think there's about 160 youngsters in the Child Care Center. Go ahead, David.
I hit randomize, is that all right?
That's what happened. This is the Johnson Art Museum edition, so I'm sure you recognize the museum. That's another signature architect, I.M. Pei, Pritzker Prize-winning architect. The building was put up, I think, in the 60s. And the addition that you see on the left side of that, the shorter building, is I.M. Pei's company called Pecos Free. We put that project out to bid earlier this year. Bids came in quite a bit higher than we wanted them to, so we're making a few changes that I don't think are going to really change the appearance or the quality of the building, but we're trying to get the price to come down. Fortunately, the market is changing a lot, so everybody knows what's going on in the economy. As you might imagine, contractors are a whole lot hungrier than they were 6 months ago, and we're expecting prices to be more competitive because of that. We'll reprice the addition to the Art Museum probably in January and February and hopefully get it into the ground, get started on it in early spring. Go ahead, David. And there's a section of that project, so you see the existing building on the left, and there's a whole lot of it underground that you don't see. The museum has an enormous collection, and this is the first edition that they had to find a place to store a lot of the pieces that they have. Right there. Here's Milstein Hall.
Milstein Hall is at the end of the design phase. It's still in site plan approval, and it's probably a project that you've read about in the paper. So we're doing an environmental impact statement for that. We're towards the end of that process. Be seeking site plan approval for it in the winter, and then break ground for it in early spring. This is a complicated project. The cantilever piece that you see there involves some really unusual pieces of steel. We're working with subcontractors now to explain what this project is all about so that they feel a little bit more comfortable with some of the unusual aspects of it. We're trying not to scare away when we actually put it on the street and bid it. So we'll be seeking bids for this one early next year, thank you, David, and then going into construction. And if you push the button again, David, we'll back up a little bit more, and behind the Herbert F. Johnson sign, there's an entrance to a parking structure that's part of the Milstein project. And David, please share with me how many spaces we're gaining there.
I think that it's about 200 gross spaces, which would be a net gain of 100.
Mm-hmm.
Just on the same footprint, but two trays.
And this
so
is
we're
a
building more parking spaces, and we're building in the one on Forest Home Drive.
Yes.
Is there not any worry that if you build it, then you'll drive?
Most of these represent spaces that have been lost in other projects. Martha Van was 100 spaces. It becomes 300 because it's going to have three trays of parking. But there was parking loss on Tower Road and Alumni Fields with the Life Sciences building. There was parking loss to the Bailey project, and there was others. And the temporary parking on the Ag Quad, which nobody really wants there. Is going to be there only until the Martha Van project is finished. It nestles it away in a way that is less intrusive to the campus and requires a shorter drive.
It doesn't seem to support the whole idea that we'll be using driving when we're building all these new parking.
But it represents maintaining somewhat of a status quo with the number of parking spaces. Even as the number of people continues to grow, what T-Guys is looking at is not increasing the amount of parking, even as the population increases.
And it's, I would add, and Mina would probably be able to talk a lot about that, it's consistent with the campus master plan to put underground parking in. And I think over the long haul, the goal is to keep the number of spaces fairly steady. David. This is the that's Gannett, and there's a project that's just starting design for a new health services building. And I've heard several people talk about the financial climate here at the university and the president's 90-day pause, and this project is on pause for a while and not clear when it's going to wake up again. Go ahead, David. Physical sciences, this is the big one that's in construction on East Avenue. Between Baker and Rockefeller. This new lab building will come online in 2010. Go ahead, David. And again, this is a LEED 30 building. Here's a nighttime view of the same thing. David.
How can it be energy efficient when it's all glass facing west and it has all this light shown blazing all night?
I can talk a little bit about that. Actually, you know what? I'm going to ask Mr. Lacey.
Sure, glad to. I don't know about the lights. I think that's just for a rendering. But actually, all of the glass you see on the west enters the atrium, so it's a circulation space and not used space. So it's semi-conditioned space. It's sort of like putting the mudroom as you enter a house, then you don't condition it the same way you would your house. And this building was designed around that. The other really interesting thing about this building, which is also true of Duffield Hall, is that by connecting the building to two adjacent buildings, we've removed what were exterior walls and made them interior walls. So the wall of Baker that one time had heat loss through the windows, the wall, and the whole wall of Clark, which is a lot of glass, are now interior walls. So you really gain no new exterior walls by locating the building up against the two existing buildings, which is a pretty neat thing to do.
But in the summer facing west, is it not going to get really hot in there?
It may, but it has shading. The shading integral with the walls. At one point design, we were kind of excited because that west wall was to be a double wall with a ventilated airspace in between, and it was pretty expensive, so we lost that, but they did retain the shadings at integral with the windows.
They also cut down 7 or 8 huge mature green trees that would have been in shape.
I think a lot of these concerns, and we've all heard a lot of these concerns, and they are definitely there. For the sake of time, because we are a little bit pressed, why don't we hold off on a lot of the questions until the end and let the presentation kind of go through, just for the sake of time right now.
Okay, and I'll zip right through them. This is the new humanities building at Goldwyn Smith. Early in design, there's an artist rendition of what the interior of the atrium might look like. And again, as I mentioned with another one, this one is probably part of the pause that we're all talking about. Go ahead, David. This is the reason that the piece of Campus Road is closed. We're doing some work at the hotel school. Go ahead, David. That's what it'll look like when we're all finished. David? There's a whole lot of things going on in the College of Engineering. The college did a master plan about a year ago. So the building that you see, COE, and we have no idea what the building footprint will really look like, but that's a future lab building for the College of Engineering. You see a PH1, that's phase one of a building for computer sciences in early design. So there's lots of things being planned in the engineering quad. Go ahead, David. The human ecology building, somebody mentioned parking, so there's parking underneath that as well. That's the replacement for Martha Van Dorp, the building that has some structural problems in that compound. Go ahead, David. Another project proposed in Martha Van. Martha Van is getting a complete facelift and new mechanical systems, and to see that structure in the corner is the result of some of the circulation problems in the building. Go ahead, David. This is the last in the School of Labor Relations, the last major capital project that's going on right now. Right there. And click it again. It's a replacement for Stocking East. It's a new food sciences lab for Dallas. It's an early design. Right there. And that's a really neat project that it's a continuation of the nuclear studies program. So the yellow circle that you see is the electron storage ring that's been in operation 30 or 40 years, and the rest of it is sort of the next generation of that. The university will be making a grant application to the National Science Foundation probably early next year for funding. But it's a great big project to keep Cornell right in front of the synchrotron business. Go ahead, David.
And the extension of the synchrotron is the yellow dash, not the red, right?
No, the red is just the project area. And I think we'll
find out
that most of it
below grade. Yeah, the orange dotted line is all underground, the same way the yellow circle is, and then sort of the pinkish color is the laboratory building. Go ahead, David.
Okay.
And this is a project, a new visitor center at Plantations that we're just about ready to put out to bid. That'll include a whole lot of site work, some parking, but mainly a new center for people visiting the Plantations. And the Animal Health Diagnostic Center, for those of you who go out to East Campus on occasion, is a new laboratory building that's in construction. We broke ground on that in the spring. And then here's a project, right, and Randy's and Nina's and my own division, combined heating and power. And what an excellent project this. This project by itself reduces the university's carbon footprint. How much? 30%? 30%? That's a big deal.
It depends on the weather.
folks a dose of our own medicine, because there's a whole lot of other stuff going on inside our building, which is what we inflict on everybody else most of the time. Go ahead, David.
That power to learn.
And then this isn't a building project, but this is what's been going on in the building industry since 2000. Just enormous escalation, primarily in material costs. It's way above the consumer price index. And I showed two lines there. One is sort of the raw material inputs and the raw labor inputs to a model that predicts cost increases in the construction industry. And I separated that from the selling price because the difference between the labor and material inputs and the selling price is the risk that the contractors have to mitigate in order to stay successful. People who are selling materials like steel and copper and stuff like that, they won't guarantee their prices. There's just enormous volatility in the business that I'm in right now. It's hard to predict how much things are going to cost. And that just gives you an idea of over time what it looks like. Go ahead, David. That's it.
Are we going to go directly into the next presentation? Or can we make some
discussion? For a couple minutes, I was kind of holding it off to the end so we have the presentation.
Well, I was just curious about where sustainability, I know we're going to have a presentation about sustainability in this often, and how much of an impact does the new thinking, I guess you could say, or the new insight about what constitutes sustainable practices in building, what constitutes sustainable practices in land use or sustainable practices. Practices even transportation. How much of a vigorous kind of input is there on a project by project, plan by plan basis? And what comes to mind is, I mean, look, Elizabeth's questions about glass and so forth. Now, I mean, some of us look at the Green Channel and some look at one, you know, channel, the Sundance Channel, which has all these green. Not Ed Begley, because he's boring. The other, where there's some interesting ideas about architecture, sustainable architecture, sustainable planning, that are very different from, although we're going in that direction, don't get me wrong, material use, that are very different. They're pioneering people who actually spend their time working as well as they can to get at the lowest common denominator. And I had this question for Nina about a project that was brought up that was mentioned by John, which has to do with putting 180 cows on 8 acres of land right next to the apple orchard and right next to the Cascadilla Creek. And I was thinking, you know, how much do we actually look at being ahead of the curve, I guess you could say, on sustainability, carbon footprint, and stuff like that? In these projects that John brought up, I don't know whether
I think the presentation followed will kind of be a bit of an answer.
I guess maybe you're going to talk about it.
Specifically on buildings, we can talk about the Green Building Oversight Committee, which chair of.
Yeah, the GBOC is a committee that's been around for 2 or 3 years. A number of folks here are members of that, but although we haven't written it down this way, the mission, I think, of that group is to push the administration and trustees as hard as we can on this topic. The LEED 30 initiative came from the Green Building Oversight Committee. I will tell you that when we presented the concept of LEED 30 and that all New Cornell buildings would be LEED Silver and that 30% of the load would be the floor, that we would choose to do better than that, there was a lot of discussion about that. There was a lot of discussion about, well, that makes sense from a bottom line perspective, and we talked about triple bottom line. So, as you might imagine, there's a significant culture here that over time we intend to change. But of course, it takes time.
So, even with the, I guess you could say, increased pace of I mean, I'm talking about, for example, this presentation was made at the Senate by David Harris and others, talking about the role of sustainability and whether cost effectiveness was factored into whether or not sustainability would be. Although, central and important, and the president rightly puts it as an area we all have to make suggestions, and you know, as opposed to leaving it out completely because it's, you know, a fad or something like that. I'm just thinking in terms of construction. You guys have a chance to say no, I mean, we can be ahead of the curve. I mean, you know, we can. Maybe the restrictions are from higher up. You know, and therefore, what you're saying is we can't be ahead of the curve because, you know, there's a policeman out there.
Well, I mean, at the end of the day, our sustainability initiatives, they're different. Some of them are perceived as risky. Some of them are perceived as not having a soon enough payback. Some of them come at the expense of programs. So none of them, or few of them, are free. Few of them come easily. And I think we may talk about this during the next presentation. The neat thing about it, though, is 2 years ago, the Green Building Oversight Committee was sort of the only group that was thinking about this and pushing forward. It's grown more than tenfold on the campus. The President's Climate Commitment, I think, Dean, you're probably going to talk about the Climate Action Plan, is a big initiative that's going on university-wide to help the university push this ahead and change our culture. So there's different ways that people look at it. Some people look at it and say, oh, this is going fast enough, that we should be more aggressive. And then other people are scared and less willing to embrace it. And I'm quite sure it's the right thing. And it's our job to negotiate that.
The only thing I'd like to add is I just came back from the ASIA conference, which is the national organization for sustainability in higher education, and I were there. A lot of the presentations showed we are well ahead of the curve. We'd like to do much better, but the University of Pennsylvania is just getting energy metering on all of their buildings. And we've had that around for years. And I was talking to my peers, the IB presidents, a meeting in December to discuss what they should be doing around labs, which is our biggest energy use. And all of our peers were like, well, Randy's on the Lab 21 group, and he presented this year on carbon neutral labs in buildings. And so they're using us as the case study throughout the IB. So in a lot of cases, we are way ahead of the curve, particularly the Climate Action Plan and other areas. You might not see it because a lot of this stuff is happening behind the scenes in the building standards. We have documents and documents of the building standards that go out to our contractors and architects on what we're doing and how we want it built. So it's really well-built, life cycle analysis kind of building. Some of our peers have two-page documents in front and back, and that's their whole building standard for the universities. So we've done a lot of the background legwork. It might not look like it's a green building, but a lot of them are way ahead.
I think that's a good transition, even if you want to go ahead and...
Sure. My transition is Dan is the communication. and I
am correct that this ends at 6.
Correct. Yeah,
people are actually going to start walking out at 6.
Lock the door.
That sounds really good. Well, I'm not actually going to do a song and dance show, even though that's what it seems like we're up to. So I'll be pretty quick and hopefully leave some time for discussion. A lot of my peers, just people who are involved in the President's Climate Action Plan, can you please just raise your hand so people know that there's a few peers, you're both evaluating what I'm about to say, but also can answer your questions on specific areas like design, buildings, transportation, planning. So what I'm going to do is focus mostly on the Climate Action Plan. That was President Scorton signed the President's Climate Commitment in 2007. This year, September 15th, we announced our first greenhouse gas inventory, which puts Cornell at about 319,000 metric tons of CO2 a year. We put out a brochure that I'll pass around. If you could pass that away. Some of you may have seen already that both educates people about the greenhouse gas inventory, but also begins to talk about the areas in which we know we need to make significant changes in order to achieve climate neutrality in the future. So the President's Climate Commitment represents a new kind of alignment around the values of protecting the environment, being proactive as an institution. The students have been talking about for a long time, faculty have been active on, and now senior administration is very clearly making a stand on. The timeline of this is that we announced our greenhouse gas inventory this September. Over this next year, we're working to develop a climate action plan, which will include different benchmarks and strategies for achieving climate neutrality. We'll deliver that plan, the climate action plan, to the National Organizing Committee of the President's Climate Commitment next September. So we're kind of right in the midst of the planning process. It's and I'm just going to walk us really quickly through a few of those stages. We're beginning to wrap up, and we'll wrap up officially on December 1st, phase one, which was idea generation, of getting all the ideas on the table, both from our staff, but anyone really in the entire community and the region. So if you're still interested, go to the website on this brochure, and just two clicks away, you can find what we call our idea exchange. And we're cataloging every idea that people bring to us, big or small. And this is really a way to get both our professionals and the community at large to engage in thinking about actionable ideas that the university can take. At the same time, Mike Walsh, the student trustee, has been organizing with student organizations and student government, and just 2 weekends ago had the student leaders summit on what students can do to take the lead on climate neutrality. And we're going to be eventually kind of pairing those up so there's both an institutional plan and a student-led plan. At the same time that we're doing this idea exchange and this getting all the ideas on the table, we also have groups meeting in all of what we call the wedge areas. Mike's holding up a chart that shows our greenhouse gas inventory, kind of the greenhouse gas levels going up and down over the last few years, the significant drop when the combined heat and power plant comes online, and then that top line up into the top right-hand corner is the status quo. We kept growing, our greenhouse gas impacts would keep going up, and we know we need to make cuts in at least 5 major areas that are represented on the back of this brochure. If you just turn the brochure over, are the 5 that we call wedge areas or action areas. So we've pulled together faculty and staff and now some students who are trying to sort through all these ideas in all of these 5 areas. We're also developing a sustainable decision-making framework, which will be the first time the university actually attempts at something that some people would describe as triple bottom line accounting or triple bottom line decision-making. And that's it's an experiment, and we're going to use it to try to filter through this long list of ideas for climate neutrality to come up with a portfolio of options that will be viable economically, will it be institutionally appropriate, that is, Cornell and all the different stakeholders will be excited about these different pieces, and it will have the biggest greenhouse gas impact. There's a lot of other criteria, and there's a committee that's working on that, and there'll probably be some announcements around what that will look like after we get back from winter break, but I'm not guaranteeing anything, but that's just a committee, it's in process. And so this spring, we're going to start actually having some different, it won't really look like portfolios, but some clear areas where we know we're going to have to move into some of these. And so there are going to be some engagement sessions. We're not sure exactly how they're going to look, if they're going to look like open houses or more like working sessions on different themes, where constituents across campus and in the larger community could start to drill down on some more specific areas. I think a few key things that I've left out so far was that where we got the money to do this and who's helping us. NYSERDA, the State Energy and Research Development Authority, which everyone is paying a few cents to every time you buy electricity in New York State, they've put up about half of the planning funds for this project, and Cornell matched, so they matched Cornell. They put up that money for Cornell to hire an external consultant to work with us on the planning effort, which would be really the most substantial climate neutrality planning effort in New York State. And as Dean mentioned, a lot of our peers around the country are looking at as a national, setting national precedent. So NYSERDA helps us bring on board affiliated engineers, Trowbridge, I guess it's, no, it's not Trowbridge, it's Martin Alexian, what is it? Martin Alexian Bryson has worked on transportation projects with our transportation office before, and Energy Strategies Incorporated. The 3 of those companies are working together to help facilitate this whole process that I just outlined, and will be with us through the summer. So as I mentioned, September 15th next year is when we deliver the climate action plan. The Board of Trustees will probably be seeing that the early part of the summer, if not late spring. We're probably going to be coming back and engaging with you in various different situations on campus after winter break, when we're kind of going to start drilling down into some specific areas. I know you guys have scheduled time for a conversation about sustainability in general. I guess we don't really have too much time for that. I did bring a copy of the Cornell Chronicle that they did on sustainability at Cornell for the state fair. Cornell, for the first time, had a major presence at the state fair focused on sustainability. And so this newspaper actually outlines a few of the things that are going on across the campus. There's another document that's on the sustainablecampus.cornell.edu website. If you haven't visited that yet, this document, the Advancing Sustainability Action Plan document, it's available to download on the website. This covers all eight areas of sustainability at Cornell operations. So climate and energy is just one of them. It's got this nice little page here. So endowment investments, food and water, waste and pollution, transportation, materials, the built environment, climate commitment and energy and land use are all dealt with in this. And there's different working teams in those different areas. Many of them are represented in this room right now. So since we don't really have too much time to talk about that, do you want to add anything to that?
This isn't really for you, this is more about campus planning. I noticed during the presentation and even just walking around Cornell, and I've heard a lot about this from undergraduates, that the new buildings don't look like they're part of a quote-unquote Ivy League campus. And I was wondering if there will be any sort of effort in the future to make new buildings fit in with the old buildings, and sort of try and keep a consistent look throughout the campus.
It would be nice if the university architect were here to feel that.
It's a design question more than a plan question.
Okay.
What did you say, Mina?
I said it's a design question more than a planning question.
Well, I think that's true. I also, I don't know what would happen if we took a poll and asked the whole group of the university what they thought of our new building.
Very good idea. Yeah, some that come up. I think something that has been around from probably the early 20th century is I don't know if this is a decision or it's been a policy that Cornell will build buildings off this time or build in it. There's been a conscious effort to not get design that sort of refers to one age of history, but to be, have buildings that represent. The trick, though, is, how do you get a building that's contemporary, that expresses the time it was built, but is different to a lot of standing. So I think, again, as John said, it's a good question to take back to Gilbert.
I think this is a question that's asked a lot
from
new students. I think that as you first get on campus, a lot of the architecture tends to, but I think that's part of kind of the character of the campus as well. What I was hoping that we would be able to discuss, I guess, in the last 5 minutes that we have, is what is the role of this body now in the coming months, in the coming year, in Cornell's sustainability efforts, in this large, in this just pyre here? We had had discussions within our institute, within the executive board on this. And I kind of want to open this up for discussion, what our role should be.
I'd actually like to see a committee here talk about sustainability, because I know, you're talking to Dean about this, ad infinitum about the fact that I'm on the sustainability team in San Jose Place, there's a sustainability team in transportation services now, there's one at the lab with O. We don't really have any way of sharing information besides the fact that, the one person, Dean has to go out and try to talk to everybody and find everybody and share all these things. We know what types of negotiations we've had with our own business services people and with our own building managers about what can be done, because there are really two levels. There's the institutional level, which is utilities, which is do the lights get turned off and when, there's issues of business services, green purchasing, do they participate in green purchasing program and all these other programs that we have. And there's also the individual level, which is an educational process. I mean, I'm the crazy person that tries to get people to print double-sided and all these other things. So, you know, I'm really interested in helping Dean leverage his ability to communicate with faculty, staff, and students all together. So it seems like this is really the main place that that could happen.
I agree. I mean, we are the custodians of the code, right? And the code is given as it's the reason we are is that it's thought that it's everybody is the same under the code. The employees, we fought that out and we won it as we passed this initiative last year, last year. And one could say the same about the sustainability initiative. One of the reasons why we had the meeting, I think, was with the planning, the transportation, and sustainability all coming together and facilities, is that the view is that if we can have a common format for employee, student, graduate student, and faculty to say this, a format in which all the ideas can be aired, we're serving as a kind of coordinating body of campus opinion, the way we did for the code. And I think we can entertain questions like what's the architectural tenor of the campus, if there is one particular one. We can discuss that. I know you shake your head, there isn't, and I kind of agree. We could talk about adaptive reuse versus building new buildings. I'm really happy to hear there's a committee very seriously involved and engaged in that. But I think that kind of idea should be out in front of the whole community. That is to say, what is the place of adaptive reuse as a sustainability effort versus building a new building? What is the place of bringing in steel beams, you know, that have to be, you know, all these other, or glass structures? And it can be done not as a student initiative alone, although student initiatives are important, but it can be done as a part of a kind of representative body of all the constituents.
But then the onus is also on each of us as representatives. I know that I have a sustainability marketing communications plan for my division. And we implemented today, we had transportation services and TCAT come and talk to our employees about Vanpool, because we have 40% of our employees who come from out of the area. So it's things like these that I think that each person here needs to implement a marketing communications plan in their own area.
Sure.
Asa, you had something.
I was just wondering to hear a little bit from the individuals who presented. I mean, I know we're hearing a lot about these plans, and, you know, let's hope to extend all the roads and things like that in the city, but given the financial nature and the things that are going on recently with, you know, the whole financial marketplace for parents and for employees who are losing jobs and so forth, what sort of things are being taken into place now to say, you know what, instead of maybe investing $10 million on roads or something of that nature, that could be $520,000 scholarships for students. What sort of things are being looked at to say, well, maybe we had all these dreams, we had all these things where we can revise and re-edit and bring to, you know, 22nd century, whatever we want to call it, types of buildings, but how are we making sure that we don't lose sight, I guess, of the mission, what this university was founded on for all students, not just students that, you know, have the means to come and pay it for, you know, $50,000 a year?
I'd like to echo that. That's a wonderful question. And, I mean, the problem with all these presentations where we just get shown an endless array of new building projects is, I mean, they're really pretty horrifying if you consider that the money is all fungible. And if they only had a more sensible design for Millstein, for example, and didn't have to take over a city road maintenance to have it, and it was more in useful space, more energy inefficient, fit in better with the community, you could probably save $20 million. And
sure.
You could spend it 30
million. We're all getting a little off.
Somebody has to ask
right
big
now.
Questions about building on the campus.
But this is, I mean, we're coming into this discussion, and I was hoping what the discussion now is degraded and we're running out of time, but what this body is going to do with that, I understand there are big questions out there, and I don't disagree that those are things that ought to be addressed. I just don't think this is the setting in which that
I don't know where it is.
It's not here.
You can go back and forth.
It wasn't asking the faculty senate. it wasn't asked, I don't know, maybe the employee assembly is doing it, maybe the, but the faculty senate didn't say a word about it, we just accepted the presentation, blah. You know, and we didn't have the questions. Now, maybe she'll regard some of these as individual pet peeves or something. I don't think so. I think they can be a part of a broader university discussion. I agree with Kelly that if we had some kind of body, a committee, whether it be committee of the whole or something like that, mm-hmm. that could point these questions. And I think, you know, Asa and Rebecca's points are very much integrated with that.
I think my point is just the discussion of how that will take place. My point is, yes, these questions need to be asked, but how will we go about addressing them? Because obviously...
There's a quick answer to that, though. I actually mentioned it last time, and maybe it's because I hear these presentations a lot being in the revenue center, because we are charged with that. So $300 million in campaign gold taken away from new buildings and reallocated to scholarships and faculty support, because people, as they just said, people are the value. So that is kind of concurrent with the freeze on some new building projects. That's the short answer. The information is out there. So that's where the money is going to go. So endowed scholarships and endowed
scholarships. At a very high level, President Scorton, with the advice and essentially consent of others, has set a set of priorities for the university. And number one, two on the list is maintaining student aid, scholarships, and those kind of things. I don't know what its growth will be, or if we all step back, its growth, its subtraction is forecasted to be less than where other areas might lose more. So he and others have made a commitment to that, and there are probably any number of forms. If somebody thinks they've got the formula wrong, and they bring it here and can convince a number of us, we can certainly submit a resolution to have something re-looked at. I can tell you, though, also, if during times of depression or recession / whatever it is, building gets generally cheaper. It's a good time to build. It puts a lot of people to work. It generates a lot of revenue, a lot of taxes, and you can leverage a lot of money for these students to move in long-term sustainability. Green can be, I mean, there's a balance. The bottom line is there's a balance, and you got to feed people as well as provide the student aid. So I guess our role, I see it, is, you know, there's definitely some policies that if they should be more universally accepted university-wide, we can probably help with that as far as, you know, should every college or department have, you know, some people looking at things. If we think the big level proportions of money and you know, to style versus to aid are out of whack or seem to be out of whack, we certainly have a voice that can raise that concern, and that would be our role too. I think we need to be apprised and connected, but unless there's an issue, I don't think we need to create one, unless we see that there's not enough green or things are just violating too much common sense, or, you know, I know there's a lot of fear and trepidation, but
well, green space is disappearing at a huge rate, and the construction is just incredible. Students complain all the time that it's constantly disruptive, and when you consider that it's those millions of dollars could be spent on, as you said, program, on student aid, on research money for faculty, which is pitifully small, things that would really make the university matter. And there must be ways. I like your idea about sharing the wealth, but let's have people putting in solar panels instead of building buildings covering up green space, because that's really not sustainable.
Okay, I'm going to cut you off for a second. In the interest of time, because we are running over our meeting, I'd like to invite the University Assembly to send an email to myself, seth.pardo@cornell.edu, or Mark, or Rodney, and we will bring it up in our next executive meeting, because it's clear, in the interest of time, we have to wrap it up today, but that this is something that we do want to and need to continue the conversation of. And just to summarize some of the voices that we've already heard here on the floor, this does seem to be an issue that the University Assembly has the scope and the authority with which to talk about and to create resolutions about in order to provide recommendations to the desk of the president. And clearly, that is something that we can and should do. The break that we're putting on the conversation today is simply in the interest that we don't have the agenda time to address it today. Okay, so I invite you, please, send us your emails, send us your comments, and we'll make it onto a future agenda item, because it is something we need to continue to talk about.
Okay.
Just hopefully without any contention, I just wanted people to know that the Center for a Sustainable Future is another avenue to be aware of, and there's several people around campus who are interested in making April again, as it was in President Lehman's last year, Campus Sustainability Month, and because it's around Earth Day and there's already a lot of things going on, I'm sure that there's a role that the University Assembly could play in during that month and have visibility for whatever you guys do.
Thank you.
Motion to adjourn in the second.
All in favor? Opposed? Thank you all of our presenters and all of our guests. This discussion will be continued, and again, please send us emails, specific issues, things like that, and give them how we're going to address it.
I really
really get it. Like,
of course, we're not going to get a payoff.
And you know what? You make me beautiful, and he makes me 30, and it happens to him.
Okay, now I wanted to ask you about that.
This has been a production of Cornell University, on the web at cornell.edu.